Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report, the Figge Report, Tackle the Debt Before It's Too Late, right after this message. Well, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood, and that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view. Here's what he said about it in Matthew 24, verse 22. He said, quote, "Except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive," unquote. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in the Scripture detailing this New World Order and their Global 2000 genocide plan. The Scripture teaches us preparation for this great tribulation, not apathy or indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians like Ted Kennedy, Arlen Specter, Hillary, or that guy John in the Justice Department, and let's prepare to live through and survive this Global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to begin. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours. It's reserved for you. The number is 417-273-4967. And remember, the Subsistence and Survival School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, back in 1982, President Reagan commissioned a commission to study the national debt and the budget deficits. At that time, they were running about $128 billion a year. 10 years earlier, the national debt stood at less than a half a trillion dollars, that's 1974, with a budget deficit of under $10 billion. $10 billion today is chicken feed. Why, that $10 billion today would get lost in the cracks. But by 1982, the debt had swollen to over $1 trillion, and by 1990, it was over $3 trillion. Today, it stands at more than $7 trillion and climbing at the rate of $1 trillion a year. What's the result that is going to occur at some point in the future based upon those numbers? What's going to happen? Well, the Grace Commission sat down, put a computer program together, and worked out the numbers, and they said, okay, here's the ultimate end. You know, it isn't rocket science. You can do this yourself. They just completed a study on Social Security and said Social Security will be bankrupt by 2042. Some have it to bankrupt by 2032, some as late as 2052, but somewhere between 2030 and 2050, and you can expect Social Security in its present form with the number of people drawing from it, the number of people paying into it, the rate of tax that's going into the fund, the current rate of inflation. You put all these factors together and just program it out for the future. It's kind of like figuring out your mortgage payments and the interest rates and how much of it's interest and how much of it's principal and how do you calculate the interest. You know, these are just numbers. You can crunch the numbers and come up to numerical conclusions. Arthur Schlesinger once made an observation. He said, history is not necessarily a guide to the past. Now, when I was a child growing up, they taught me that he who fails to learn the lessons of history is bound to repeat them. Have there ever been other countries in the world that have followed the same kinds of economic policies or programs that we Americans have been following over the last 50 years? And could we look at those as a guide to, well, what kind of a result did they get and what kind of a result do you think we should expect? If you looked at the Roman Empire, as Edward Gibbon did back in 1876, he wrote a book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and he wrote five specific causes for their decline and fall. The debasing of their currency was one of the five. Do you suppose that the debasing of our currency in the United States of America could cause our empire, our civilization, our nation to collapse into the ash heap of former empires? Could it? Has it ever happened before? And if it's happened before, has there ever been a time in history when somebody took a look around and said, listen, the way we're handling this is leading us to trouble. Let's stop here and turn around and go back. Has that ever happened in history? Has any nation, civilization, city-state, or empire ever gone to the precipice of total destruction and then turned around and went the other way? Well, there are two examples of that in history. Two. ancient Nineveh was one, and a king in Judah, one king in Judah, turned the country around and saved it from its destruction for 38 years. Nineveh saved it from destruction for 40 years. Those are the only examples in all of the history of mankind where civilizations, city-states, nations, or empires ever took a look at the policies they were following and then stopped dead in their tracks, turned around, and prevented it for a period of time. They didn't prevent it forever, permanently. They didn't solve the problem, but there was a temporary fix. Do you think that that's possible in America? Well, the Figge report said, yeah, we think that it's possible if we get our act together and we do something about it. President Reagan recognized that there was a problem that needed solving and commissioned the Grace Commission and said, figure out the answer to this and let's see if we can implement it. President Bush is looking at the Social Security problem and he is proposing a solution. It may not be the right solution, but if you continue on with Social Security just exactly the way it is programmed today, it'll self-destruct at some point in the future. We're not talking about will it self-destruct or won't it? Everybody's in agreement that it's going to self-destruct unless something is done. All they're complaining about or all they're concerned about or all their dialogue about is when. Is it 2032, 2042, or 2052? Sometime in that 20-year period, it's going to self-destruct. Now, if that's what you're looking for, if that's the result that you want, you should continue on with the plan that you have in form right now. Guaranteed. If that isn't the outcome you want, then you've got to do something. You've got to change something. And you might argue about, well, what should we change? How should we change it? What should we do next? That's what debate's all about. Well, Harry E. Figge Jr. wrote a report. It's fairly short. I think I can cover it here in this hour. If not, we'll finish up in the next one. But it is so important. It was so shocking that when I read this report, only about 10 pages long, and I read this in 1990, 12 pages long, I said, you know, it looks like to me that it's all over. I mean, the United States of America, it's all over. I'm going to make that prognostication because I don't think America is going to be that third country that's going to make any meaningful change and solve our problem. So I feel like I'm riding on the Titanic. I'm looking for a way off. I'm going to take care of myself first, and if the rest of you can figure out how to save yourselves, well, good for you. If you can't, well, then you'll just be another one of the many victims. And in every disaster, there are victims and there are survivors. Always victims and survivors. Out of World War II in Germany, there were victims and survivors. Out of the Russian gulags, there are victims and there are survivors. Out of the Holocaust, there are victims and survivors. Off the Titanic, victims and survivors. Out of the Roman Empire, victims and survivors. That's the way life is. Sometimes it's by happenstance. Sometimes people are just lucky. It's the luck of the draw, they say. In some cases, there are people that planned for it, prepared for it, and saved themselves because they could look ahead and see that there was a problem that needed to be fixed. Some years ago, I looked at Social Security in 1978, and I said, I don't think this thing is fixable. President Reagan came up with a Social Security fix that was supposed to last forever, I guess. What they're talking about today is, let's fix the thing for 50 years. President Carter, fix Social Security for 50 years. President Reagan, fix Social Security for 50 years. Why can't you fix Social Security forever? Why can't you get the thing set up on a logical basis, on an economic basis that makes sense? Or is it because Social Security is built on a foundation of sand? It's a Ponzi scheme that can't be fixed. It can only be tended to. Well, that was my conclusion back in 1978, so I opted out of the program. Now I'm 65 and can't draw the benefits that I could have drawn had I stayed in the program. People look at me today and they say, you fool, you blind, you nitwit, you screwball. You've lost your benefits. My benefits would be $830 a month for the rest of my life, which is another 10 years, they tell me. I tell them I wouldn't get out of bed for $830 a month. If I can do better than that, it's time for me to die. Well, Figge is a businessman. Figge operates an international business out of Cleveland, Ohio. Self-made millionaire. Made a lot of money. The Grace Commission came to Figge and said, okay, give us some solutions to this. And Figge said, okay, here's my report. Now, this is 1990, so let me give you the Figge report first. And then let's take a look at the privateer and see if these prognostications, if these prophecies have actually come to pass, and how much time do you think we got left? Listen to this. Henry Figge said, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today on the subject of the national debt. And I want to stress first and foremost that I'm a businessman, and I've never been and never intend to be involved in politics. However, if you wonder why I'm up here, I really love my country, and because, as I tell people, where else but in the United States of America could a person from very humble means, whose father died when he was 16, follow his life plan and build two international companies? Well, I'm here today because I fully believe that this great country of ours is heading into serious trouble because of the government's dangerous inability to reduce its debt or to control ongoing budget deficits. I became involved in this issue quite by accident in 1982 when Peter Grace made me co-chairman of the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control of the Grace Commission. And as a result of that, I became privy to some information that I wished I'd never heard about. information that showed me how threatening our government spending policies are. Well, this past Tuesday, I met with several congressmen on the subject, including Congressman Dennis Eckert from Cleveland and Congressman Dick Armey from Texas. And I showed six different congressmen the debt and the deficit projections for the next several years, and every one of them said, gee, I didn't know that it was that bad. I didn't realize where we were headed, the congressman added. They had no idea that the ball game is going to be over sometime around 1995. Dick Armey was an economics professor and is probably the most knowledgeable man in Congress on economics. And after I showed him the projections, Dick Armey said, Harry, you just ruined my day. And I said, Dick, it's about time somebody ruined your day, because Peter Grace ruined my day back in 1982, and I haven't had a good day since. Now, surveys today show that the national debt and the deficit are uppermost in the minds of the American people. Congress recognizes this, and they say that it was the savings and loan crisis that finally brought it home to the American people. But I say that it was perfectly understandable all along, because the Americans have been struggling personally with debts and deficits and budget all of their lives. It's a part of Americans' daily lives, and they know what happens to them if they don't live within their personal income. So naturally, they begin to worry when they see a profitable country that is not being operated or run properly and cannot live within its income, and hasn't lived within its income since 1952. So I want to put this massive problem into the context of the person in the street and show you why the government is headed into real trouble. And when the government is headed into real trouble, America is headed into real trouble, and every American is headed into real trouble. Now, let's say you have a net take-home pay of $1,000, and you take $100 of that $1,000, and you put it into some kind of a pension plan, say a Kroger, an IRA, or a 401k. Now, the other $900 just makes ends meet. You're just barely able to meet all of your payments. Now, let's suppose that somebody gives you a free credit card. They give you an American Express, a Visa, MasterCard, Discover card, whatever you want. But you realize that you cannot use these credit cards, because you don't have any way to pay the credit card balance that you're going to use. Then all of a sudden, you meet a very tall man with a long white beard. He has a big stovepipe hat, red and white striped pants, a blue cloth coat with stars all over it. And he says, my name is Sam. I'm Uncle Sam. I'm a financial expert. I'm a financial advisor. And I want you to follow my advice. I want you to follow my plan. I want you to use that credit card. And when they bill you, you just send them a 30-year IOU at 8% interest. And you say, yeah, but I have to pay the interest, even if they accept my IOUs. Sam says, that's no problem. Do you remember that $100 that you're putting in your pension program? Well, take that $100 out of that pension program and use that to pay the interest. And then you put an IOU into your pension plan. 20 years from now, you'll have 20 years worth of IOUs in your pension plan. But what do you care? Now, you may remind Uncle Sam, Uncle Sam, there's a difference between you and me. You've got a printing press in your basement, which gives you unlimited credit, but I'm going to go to jail if I do that. That's why Americans are concerned, because they know that they can't keep going on like this. It's like a sixth sense. You know it can't go on, but it's been going on for 50 years. How much longer will this continue? So before I go any further, let me explain the difference between a deficit and a debt for those of you that might not be familiar with these terms. The deficit is the shortfall that we have in any one year. So if you take $100 billion and you spend $110 billion, you get a deficit of $10 billion. So at the end of that one year, you've got to do something with that $10 billion you owe. So you move that $10 billion over into your long-term shortfall, and that becomes your total debt. Well, in 1982, the annual federal deficit was $128 billion, up from just $4 billion in 1974. The debt in 1982 was at $1 trillion, up from $484 billion in 1974. But it had taken us 200 years from the start of our republic until 1974 to create that debt of $484 billion. We had gone through World Wars I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, and we still had a very manageable debt situation. But since 1982, when the debt first hit $1 trillion, it has tripled. It's now $3 trillion. So when Peter Grace called me and a number of others down to Washington in 1982, we were commissioned by President Reagan to find some savings in the government. And I can tell you, it was like shooting fish in a rain barrel. We contributed $77 million of corporate money to the project and about 500 employees, and we found more than $424 billion in savings in 9 months. Just 9 months. We found $424 billion. We could easily have identified over $1 trillion in waste in government, but President Reagan was not interested in going any further. So of the $424 billion that we identified, Congress instituted $152 billion in savings by 1986. If you take that and spread it annually, that averages $38 billion in savings every year. And at the same time, President Reagan pushed through a $50 billion tax increase. Now, you take the $50 billion in new revenue and the $38 billion that we saved, that's $88 billion. That should have gone to reduce the deficit, which at the time was $128 billion a year. So we should have dropped the annual deficit from $128 billion a year to $40 billion a year. But instead of doing that, the government says we ran a $152 billion deficit last year. You see, the problem is this. In the last 10 years, government revenue has risen at 8% a year, compounded. But expenditures have gone up 11% a year, compounded. Now, that doesn't sound like too much, but let me put it in perspective for you. Right now, Congress has 116% more money to spend than they had 10 years ago. But they have spent 186% more than they spent 10 years ago. And every time you give them a dollar, they're spending between $1.58 and $1.68. And I'll tell you what. Here's what I learned in Washington. They not only don't understand this problem, they don't give a damn about it either. Now, the thing that finally brought me up short and has ruined my last 8 years were the projections that Peter Grace got from his economist. And these numbers I'm going to give you, and I've had these numbers verified in the last 6 months by the Citizens Against Government Waste, so they're current and they're accurate as of 1990. We were at $1 trillion in debt in 1982. Now, that debt is going to go to $13 trillion in the year 2000 if we continue on spending and taxing at the current rate. And we were at an annual deficit of $128 billion, and the deficit is going to go to $2 trillion a year if we continue on the same course that we have over the past 8 years from 1982 to 1990. Now, let me graph the debt on my thumb and forefinger. I've got my thumb horizontal and my finger vertical. You've got 1776 way out here at the tip of my thumb. The debt runs along this line of my thumb absolutely flat until 1976, gets up into the web of my thumb in about 1980 and starts to come up. About 1995, we're at the first knuckle of my finger. Now you turn asymptomatic and you start going straight up. And by the year 2000, you're straight up to the top. So what does that mean? Well, it means that when we hit the $500 billion deficit here in 1995, going to a $2 trillion deficit in the year 2000, we've lost our ability to control our economy by taxation and spending. And we run the risk of something that I'm going to talk about, which is called hyperinflation. Hyperinflation. Well, back in 1982, I said, well, we've got some time and nobody's going to be this stupid. So we're going to get some people to understand this thing, and I'm very sorry to tell you that as I stand here in 1990, that we're somewhere between 1990 and 1993 in our deficit projections, a little ahead of our target, 1995. Now, I was with Senator Robert Dole the other day. He just came from the White House budget negotiations, and he said, we didn't make any progress again today, but we will, he said. Now, you've all heard about Graham Rudman. He used to be Graham Rudman and Hollings, but Senator Hollings said that he wanted a divorce from the bill because it was such a travesty. Graham Rudman originally said that he would have a zero deficit in 1991, but revised that to $60 to $65 billion a couple of years later. Now, the reason that Congress runs around like chickens with their heads cut off right now is technically, unless they get a budget agreement, they've got to cut $100 billion out of the budget this year because they're at $168 billion. So the thing that I want to tell you is that the $168 billion that you hear about is a travesty. It's a lie that has been foisted off on the American people. Now, remember all those IOUs that you were peeling out to your pension fund and your credit card fees? Well, the government doesn't count those as a part of the cash deficit. That's not part of the accounting practice. We have, for the past 6 years, run an actual deficit in the U.S. government of over $250 billion a year. And this year, we're running between $360 and $435 billion. Now, let me explain that to you. You start with the Graham Rudman bill. That's $168 billion. Now, remember the credit card example when you took $100 from your Kroger or your IRA and you sent them an IOU? Well, the government is doing that same trick. And they do that to 9 trust funds, including Social Security, military pensions, railway pensions, and postal pensions. So the U.S. government is taking $120 billion in trust fund surpluses, and they're replacing those trust fund surpluses with IOUs instead of funding them with cash. And they're funding them with federal deficits. They don't count those IOUs, and they don't count the interest on them either. And when those IOUs start coming due, the government is going to owe trillions to Social Security, which will be supporting more retirees with fewer workers. So that's the first thing that's been foisted off on the people. Now, the savings and loan crisis is another. Mossbacher, our country's head economist, made very sure when George Bush Sr. stuck his neck out on the savings and loan crisis that those costs were taken off of the deficit. And current estimates are that savings and loans will cost us $500 billion overall and $100 billion next year. Now, that's another $100 billion that's not being counted. It's not being counted. So the deficit has gone from $168 billion to $388 billion, and I haven't talked to you yet about the student loan problem. I haven't said a word about the $300 to $500 billion toxic waste cleanup bill that's going to become one of our big problems from our military bases alone. I haven't talked to you about crack babies, AIDS, or any new programs that Congress is talking about. So right now, as of 1990, The true deficit at the federal level is already between $300 and $500 billion a year. And my estimate is that at $500 billion, we lose our capacity to control that debt, that deficit, by taxation. Now, don't ever think for a minute that Congress doesn't want inflation, because they know that the only way out of this debt debacle, the only way that they can pay off the debt, is with inflated dollars. Now, if that isn't bad enough, the financial structure of the United States is now very tenuous. Let me give you a couple of examples. We definitely have a recession on the horizon, and we're just beginning to see it. And we're seeing it in furniture and housing, all through construction and in aerospace. So let's talk about our commercial banks. Since 1983, 713 commercial banks have failed in 7 years. That's more than 100 banks a year. Now, that's only 5% of the commercial banks in the United States, but when 5% of your banks fail in good times, can you imagine what bad times are going to do? The FDIC chairman, Bill Seidman, came out the other day and he said, if we get a severe recession, the safety net that we have under the commercial banks will never hold. There isn't enough money in the commercial banking system to hold it up. Now, most people don't realize this, but 13 insurance companies failed in 1988. 13 insurance companies failed in 1988 in boom times. Now, I'm talking about property and casualty companies, not health insurance companies. 39 failed in 1989. So we've had 52 insurance companies fail in the past 2 years. We're not in a recession. These are good times, and 52 insurance companies have failed, and 713 commercial banks have failed. Now, the other thing you don't hear about is that the federal government is underwriting $5.8 trillion of debt from things that aren't truly government, such as deposit insurance for the Federal Reserve, loan guarantees, pension programs, government-sponsored enterprises like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, direct loan programs, and it goes on and on. If we ever get a severe downturn, and after 50-some years of recovery, it's got to be sitting out there somewhere, we're going to be, to steal the words of a man whose lips we all watched very carefully, in very deep doo-doo. What I find frightening is the rapid rate of deterioration. It's the old story that the light at the end of the tunnel may be an oncoming train. When we can go 200 years and create less than $500 trillion in debt, and then in the next 16 years go from $500 trillion to $3 trillion in debt, we're really seeing things get bad fast. And the question is, what's going to happen? What's the outcome going to be? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or the staff of the network of this radio station or the network. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Tonight's report on the Figge report from the Grace Commission, 1982. Well, when Harry Figge was bringing this speech in 1990, he was making a report on the state of the economy, the state of the nation, the state of the national debt and the budget deficits in 1990, with projections that by 1995, the budget deficits would be over $500 billion a year. During the 1990s, during the Clinton years, they put a cap on. They claimed they balanced the budget. That was a lie. The budget was never balanced. But it was reduced a tremendous amount, and we wallowed through the 1990s until the year 2000, when the bubble broke. Now we've been in recession and a hyperinflated style of recovery reminiscent of Germany in the 1920s. How long can this go on? Is this the solution? Is this the correct solution? Well, Figge and the Grace Commission said no, that was the wrong solution. So what's going to happen? Well, one of the people that I respect most in government is an economist named Chuck Boucher. He was the former Arthur Andersen partner who is Comptroller General of the United States. Chuck was sent to New York City about 10 years ago to straighten out New York City financially, and he said that he and Governor Kerry sat at a table day after day, and Kerry made real tough decisions until they got New York City into the kind of economic condition where they could go out and sell their bonds again. So I took my hyperinflation scenario to Chuck, and I said, Chuck, tell me that I'm wrong, would you? And he said, you're wrong. And I said, great. So can you tell me what's going to happen? So Chuck said, we're going to have a financial panic. We're going to get to the point where the central banks of the world, like Japan and Germany, can see that we're not going to be able to service our debt. And then they're going to quit buying our commercial paper, our treasury bills and notes. So I said, well, great. Now we're going to have a financial panic. We're not going to have hyperinflation. Now, can you imagine a businessman standing around cheering for a financial panic? But nothing happened, and after 4 weeks, I started to wonder what those bonds were doing. Now, I think you know that at one point, Japan was buying about 35% of America's debt paper. But in about the last 6 to 8 weeks, the Japanese market broke, and I found that the Japanese have scaled back. But the Saudis came in and replaced the Japanese 100%. Now we're back to my scenario, which incidentally scares the hell out of me. What our charts show is this, that in 1995, we're not going to be able to control our deficit and our debt by taxation, and we're going to move to what's called hyperinflation. And by that, I mean severe runaway inflation that leads to devaluation of our currency. In Brazil and Argentina, they've lopped six zeros off of their money in the past few years. That meant that if you had $1 million at the first lop, that left you with $1,000. By the time they made the second lop, you had a dollar. Now, I'll talk a little later about that, but during World War II, when I was fighting house to house in Germany, I found an old cigar box on the floor. In it, there was a bunch of money. I picked it up, I looked at it, it was Weimar Republic money from 1923. Totally worthless. So I picked up about 8 or 10 of those bills and I liberated them. I brought them home. They hang today in my office. One especially frightens me because it is a 100 million mark note. 100 million marks. In 1923, they were taking bushel baskets of those $100 million mark notes down to the store to buy potatoes and bread. And so that's a great reminder to me. Now, if you'd like to find out about hyperinflation, well, we looked at all the countries in the world. Not just three or four, we looked at every country in the world. The German and the French experience with hyperinflation was too long ago. Israel is a microcosm. Russia is unknown. Yugoslavia was just getting started. They're up about 2,000% as of right now. So then we looked at South America and we said, that's where it's at. That's the model that we need to look at. So we picked Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia as the best examples of hyperinflation in modern times. Now the problem that I run into when I talk to people about this hyperinflation, they say, oh, you studied the banana republics. And I have two parts to my answer. The first part is, well, welcome to the United States banana republic. And the second answer, and most people don't know this, is that in 1938, the fifth largest market economy in the world was the country of Argentina. 1938, fifth largest economy in the world, Argentina. It was very sophisticated, very well run, and very knowledgeable. They had excellent agriculture, excellent manufacturing. The country was well run. The economic system was well run. And they had good natural resources. Today, in 1990, they're the world's 78th largest market. So if you think that it can't happen in the United States, you best believe that it can. It happened in Argentina. So for our study, we were very fortunate because we were able to meet with 80 top businessmen in those three countries, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. And they weren't just ordinary businessmen. They were government officials, bankers, financial executives. Well, Dr. Jerry Swanson, he's an economist from the University of Arizona, led our team, and he took one of our group controllers and our director of purchasing, and they took four trips over a two-year period to Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. Now, the thing that happened is that all 80 of these businessmen said to us, what's wrong with the United States? You are on exactly the same course that we were on, but about 20 or 30 years behind us. They said, everything that we did wrong in our country, you are doing wrong in yours. For example, you have huge budget deficits. You have a deterioration in your balance of payments. You have eroded the confidence of your currency. You have a tendency to blame outsiders and call for protectionism. And finally, the exchange value of your currency is falling. And twice since the mid-1970s, you have had to devalue your currency, and there's pressure now to devalue it again. And they said all five factors are in place in the United States of America, and the United States is following the path of hyperinflation, the same path that we followed 30 years ago. And what we can't understand is why it is that you Americans cannot see what's coming. Well, when Jerry came back from his trip, I said, Jerry, give me a synopsis. And he said, well, for years in my economics courses at the University of Arizona, I've been teaching that deficits cause inflation. And then he said, they do cause inflation. And I just saw it in three countries, Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia. And I said, okay, well, tell me about hyperinflation. How much time do you have before hyperinflation sets in? And he said, well, in Brazil, it set in 3 days. 3 days is how long it takes for hyperinflation to set in. Now, the terrible thing about hyperinflation is that once it gets started, you can't stop it. You see them trying to stop it now in Argentina. You see them trying to stop it now in Brazil. Brazil is a wonderful example. They put in wage and price controls, and then they seized 80% of the capital of the people. They did all the right things. But you see, 54% of the people work for the government, and they turned around and gave them pay increases to keep peace. And so they're reinflating their currency right now. And during the time that we're studying this, Argentina's inflation hit 5,000%, Brazil's got a 5,000% inflation rate, and Bolivia got up to 25,000%, with bursts of up to 50,000% per year. Now let me tell you how bad that is. We've got a book here that we published on how to survive hyperinflation. Hyperinflation survival, if you're a businessman, you have to be able to survive hyperinflation. So we have a picture of a guy with a huge bag going into the bank in Bolivia. And at the bank, they simply weighed the bag, and they gave him a note of exchange. Now, here's the terrible thing about this, and that is that nobody even looked inside the bag. They didn't care whether he had newspapers in there, old socks, $1,000 bills, or $10,000 bills. They didn't care what was in the bag, and that's because it was so worthless. And that's what happens in hyperinflation. So to say that this can't happen here in America is wrong, dead wrong. And I hear the argument periodically that the reason that it will not happen to us is that our deficit is only 5% of our gross national product. Well, the Brazilian and Argentine deficits are only 8% of their gross national product. It's not a huge jump from 5 to 8%. So when these economies give you the garbage, when these economists give you this song and dance that our deficit is only a few percentage points of our gross national product, that doesn't mean diddly squat. Now, if inflation hits South American standards in 1 month, a cab out to the airport will go from $15 to $600. Our guys went into a supermarket in South America, a supermarket, and they watched a lady pick up a loaf of bread, only to have the price change before she got to the cash register. Now, the standard joke down there is you take a cab, don't take a bus, because in a cab you don't have to pay until you get out, and by then, the money is worth less. Well, right now, Yugoslavia has over 2,000% inflation per year, and you have inflation in Israel. You don't read very much about that, but you have a very severe inflation in Russia, and there's inflation going on all around the world. And when you look behind it, it's due to the deficits of the governments in charge. Now, for 8 years, I've been ready to beat my head against a wall with Congress, but it wasn't until we got to this so-called budget crisis that I could even get in to see these congressmen to make any sense to them. Now, there was never a more important time than right now. There's never been a more important issue. It isn't a Democratic issue. It isn't a Republican issue. It's an American issue. Now, we've got 5 years left. 5 years. If we continue on with the same numbers that are going on today, 5 years left before we lose our capability to offset this problem. If we're going to offset this problem through taxation, and even that would be about 100% taxation, 5 years is all we've got. This is 1990. Now, the voice of the people has got to be heard, and that's why I'm talking to the League of Women Voters. We need strong operations out in the field to go and sit down with these people in Congress and in our legislatures and say, look, you either wake up or you're not coming back to Congress. Sure, Medicaid is great. Sure, Social Security is great. All of these other entitlement programs are just great, but we're not going to have them around in 5 to 10 years at all if you don't balance this budget and balance it right now. And a tax increase? Well, I guarantee that a tax increase is not going to balance it. They're going to spend 68 cents more than you give them. Whatever the tax increase, Congress is going to take that and spend it all plus something more. That's what's got to stop. Well, in closing, what I want to say to you is this. Don't think that it can't happen here. If Argentina can go from the 5th to the 78th economy in the world because of this kind of deficit problem, we can go from 1st to 50th very, very easily. And you hear people jumping on us over becoming a second-rate power, and here I am talking about becoming a third-rate power in the United States. That's what we're talking about, not second, but third or fourth. Now, I'll guarantee you this, if it hits, and I hope to God that I'm wrong, and Chuck Browser is right, but if it hits, your savings, your bonds, your insurance, your pensions, you might as well use them for toilet paper because they're not going to be good for anything else. And we know that from what we've seen around the world. Now, that's called the Figge Report. First done in 1982, he made that report in 1990. Well, 1995 is coming past, 2000 is coming past, and now we're coming up to the year 2005, and the $500 billion deficits, $500 billion a year deficits are now routine. Now, in 2004, the deficit came in the $430 billion range, but you see, they didn't count Social Security. You see, Social Security has a $100 billion plus surplus every year, and they take that money out of Social Security and they spend it in operating revenue for the country. And then they don't count that. They put an IOU into Social Security. They do the same thing now with other pension plans. They're not counting. You saw what happened at Enron when Arthur Andersen was doing the accounting. The same kind of accounting practices that went on at Enron are going on in the United States government. So you're not getting a correct balance, boys and girls. I just thought I'd share that with you. I don't know what the real numbers show, but whatever the numbers that are being published show, it's worse than that. Whatever the official numbers are, it's a lie, it's worse than that. When government says that the inflation rate is running 3%, you can bet it's running 6. When the government says that the budget deficit is $430 billion, you can bet that it's more like $800. When they're projecting a budget deficit of $500 billion, you can bet that it's probably closer to a trillion. Now, what's that going to mean to you later on? Well, as long as the world goes on like it is right now today, you don't have a problem in the world. But how much longer is this going to go on? Now, I've been preaching to the choir for the last 30 years, and so have all of the conservative economic forecasters over the last 30 years that I know of that have been saying, this can't go on, we've got to make changes. We not only haven't made the changes, we have gotten worse. In every category of debt, if you take a look in the United States of America today, it's worse today than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, or 50 years ago. In fact, if you take a look at the national debt was $257 billion about 1950. Today it's $8 trillion. So over 50 years, we haven't paid off the debt. It's gotten bigger. If you take a look at personal household debt in America, it's greater today than it was 50 years ago. If you take a look at the number of people that are working, here was a number that came across my desk. Really a shocker. Every month you hear numbers on the unemployment rate, and they say, well, unemployment is 5.5% of the workforce, 5.3%, 4.9%. It's under 5%. I've been listening to that number now for 50 years. And I thought, well, if the unemployment rate is at 5%, they tell us that's pretty good. But do you know what the employment rate is? I've never seen that number before in my life, and I'm an old man. I've never seen the employment rate. Well, I saw it today. I saw it today. The employment rate in the United States of America is 62% as of the fourth quarter, 2004. 62%. The unemployment rate is 5%. So now that tells us that 62% of us are employed. 5% of us are unemployed. Well, let's see. Doesn't that tell us that if 62% are employed, 38% are unemployed, underemployed, or not employed at all? Now, of that 38%, you know, you've got, and then they're talking about working age Americans. That's somewhere between 18 and 65. So if you're aged 18 to 65 living in the United States of America, in that population group, that demographic group, there are 62% of you employed. And the balance of you are either unemployed, underemployed, not employed, not looking for work. I'm one of those. Of course, I'm 65 now, so I guess I'd be out of the statistics. But for the last 20 years, I haven't been employed. I haven't been out looking for work. I'm not complaining. But I'd never seen the employment numbers before. Nobody ever says, gee, 62% are employed. Back in the Depression years, 25% were unemployed, but 75% were employed. Now, I heard that number someplace. 75% were employed, 25% were unemployed. The good news is, three-quarters of us were working. Today, 62% of us are working. And we're not calling this the Great Depression era now, are we? Well, you see, that's because the 75% that are working are being taxed to support the 38% that aren't working. Because it should be pretty obvious to all of us, the 38% that aren't working are being supported somehow. They're either selling drugs down on this corner, or they're getting some government check, or they're doing something, aren't they, to buy bread and milk? So I just thought I'd share that with you. If you take a look at the savings rate, well, it's below one-half of 1% of your disposable income. That's what Americans are saving. Now, it used to be 5%. In 1998, it was 5%. It dropped to one-half of 1% in the third quarter of 2001, and it's down to one-half percent in the fourth quarter of 2004. So we're not saving money in the United States, and indeed, why should we? If you take a look at the dollar and dollar-denominated assets, why in the world would anybody want to save money in the United States of America? You need to get rid of the dollars and convert them into something because they're inflating out of sight. The average inflation rate from 1960 through 2000 was 4.7% per year compounded. 4.7% compounded. If we take 72, divide that by 4.7. It doubles every 15.3 years. That means that every 15 years, you lost 50% of your purchasing power out of what you saved. Well, I should word it this way. In 15 years, you lost one half of your purchasing power. Now, That ought to shock your pants off. Why would anybody want to save money and then lose half of its purchasing power? Mortgage refinancing from 2000 through 2004, everybody has been out on a buying binge. We went out and we borrowed money on our houses, on our homes, the biggest asset that most of us have. Refinanced them and took the money and went out and bought SUVs and swimming pools, and we have been on a credit binge. Now the assets that the average American family had has now been turned into liabilities. The average American family has a $70,000 consumer debt plus a mortgage. The average family of four in the United States of America has a total net worth of $25,000. $25,000. That's less than $2,500 in 1950. $2,500 in 1950 dollars. I mean, if you count your house, your car, all your toys, your savings account, everything that you've got on average in America is $25,000 for a family of four. Chicken feed, I'd say. A house costs $161,000. That's the median price for housing in the United States. $161,000. And you got a $25,000 net worth. All right, we're just about out of time. Now, next time we come back tomorrow night, we'll take up the Privateer, number 516. Tonight's report, the Figge Report, came from Figge International. They're located at 4420 Sherwin Road, Willoughby, Ohio, 44094. It's called Figge International. For more information, just contact Figge International, Public Affairs Department, 4420 Sherwin Road, Willoughby, Ohio, 44090. The phone number, 216-953-2811. Again, that's area code 216-953-2811, the Figge Report. If that doesn't shock you back to reality, nothing will. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. And for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There's my signal. Time's up. I got to go. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.